that people think of lots of different things, and perhaps it's one of these. We have the first one. Authority, New York State Bridge Authority, the force of the police to stop you doing things that are naughty. What about this? Steve Bedford, the voice of authority and the law, being able to stop you doing things that you're not supposed to and punishing you for doing things that you have done wrong. What about this? Parents telling you what to do. Maybe some of you are a bit past that stage, but it's a voice of authority, isn't it? Certainly when you're younger. And when you're older and you perhaps are a parent, trying to enforce your authority over your children, but trying to persuade them to listen to you is quite hard. What about this one? The ranty preacher. I'm sure we don't have any of them here. But if you move on, just a blank slide. I think most people have quite a negative view of authority in our world. I don't know what you think, I don't know whether you agree with me, but I think most people think that authority is there to restrain their choice, to stop them from doing things that they might want to do. It's that kind of authority is the balance to our liberty, isn't it? So authority stops us doing whatever we want and actually constrains us to a set of behaviours or ways of living. But when we think about it, I actually think that life is a whole series of decisions about which authority we choose to follow. Some of those choices seem fairly straightforward, don't they? We choose to follow the authority of the law because if we don't, there is punishment. We do something wrong. If we break the law, we get punished for it. But what about our parents? At what point do we choose to stop listening to their authority? For some people it's quite young, for some people it's a lot older, but there is a point, isn't there, where we move out of their authority and start listening to another authority. How much do we recognise the authority of our employers when they tell us to do something that perhaps we don't want to do? For the teacher it might be teaching something that they don't agree with. Or for someone in work being told to cut corners by their boss. Do we choose to listen to that authority? Or listen to another authority? Life is a series of choices about which authority we follow. And today we're going to see how people respond to Jesus' authority. And we're going to look at two marks of Jesus' ministry as he begins to describe it to us. And the first mark of Jesus' ministry is this that we're going to look at. And it's rejection. Rejection. And it will come up on the slide. Rejection. Verses 14 to 30. Now, I don't know about you, but if I was writing a gospel and I was just starting about to tell people about Jesus' ministry, I would not start off with this story. I wouldn't start off with a story about Jesus being rejected. I think I would start off with maybe Lazarus being raised from the dead, or Jesus walking on water, or feeding the 5,000. Something pretty impressive to lay down the marker for what Jesus' life of ministry is going to be like. If a new company wants to make an impact in a market, they start off with a big advertising campaign to win people over. They don't start off with all the unhappy customers giving their reviews of their product, do they? So why does Luke start here? Following on from last week's passage, the end of Jesus' temptations, he goes into Galilee and starts preaching, and Luke tells us of his rejection in his hometown. Well, I think in verse 14 and 15 we're given a clue that this isn't the very start of Jesus' ministry, because it tells us that Jesus had already been preaching in Galilee, telling people about the good news of the kingdom. And it's not, Luke isn't telling the story chronologically, that is, in order of the events that happened, but he's telling us what's important, what we need to know. He'd already been around Jesus, teaching in the synagogues, and we get that repeated phrase, do you see it, just at the end of verse 14. The news about him spread through the whole countryside. We've seen that quite a lot already in Luke, the news about John the Baptist spread throughout the whole countryside. The news about Jesus' birth spread throughout the countryside. So So the people of Nazareth, Jesus' hometown, probably had a fair idea of who Jesus was and what he'd been doing. So to answer the question of why Luke starts here, we need to look at what happens in his hometown. In Jesus' interaction with the people of his hometown, you can kind of feel the tension, can't you? Jesus is like the prodigal son, returning home to his hometown. So the people he grew up with, what are they going to make of him? What's he going to do? There's a great weight of expectation upon Jesus as they all wait to see what he does. As he goes into the synagogue, he's handed the scroll. He opens it up to Isaiah 61. Reads two short verses and sits down. It's tension, isn't it? Everyone will be looking at him going, what? What's he doing? Luke tells us in verse 20, the eyes of everyone were on him, watching, waiting. But the events don't turn out too well, do they? We need to understand what the people expected of Jesus and what Jesus says and why it's so offensive. The prophecy that Jesus reads out in the temple is a prophecy from Isaiah 61. We need to read it to understand what Jesus is saying his ministry is going to be like. So verse 18 and 19. The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favour. The people of Israel would have known that this passage is a prophecy about the Messiah, the God's rescuer, the one who's going to come. And Jesus is saying what we found out last week. I am the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies. I am the one you have been waiting for. Right at the start of Luke's account of Jesus' ministry, Jesus is claiming to be the Messiah. In his hometown, to the people he grew up with, went to school with, kicked a football about with, Jesus is saying, I am the Messiah. So it's no surprise, is it, that people were fixed upon him after he read this little verse, the two verses, all watching and waiting to see what he'd do. He's saying, in no uncertain terms, I am the Son of God. And the people are looking at him thinking, what kind of miracle is he going to perform? What thing will he do for us, the people of his hometown? Everyone in the synagogue had their eyes on him. Everyone was amazed at his gracious words and wondered how this could be Joseph's son, it says. And it's at that point that the whole atmosphere in that synagogue gets completely turned, flipped on its head. From tense excitement, perhaps, expectation, even I think a sense of pride that this Jesus who's claiming to be the Messiah is from our hometown, to derision, hatred, and scorn. Verse 28 says, all the people were furious. Literally, they were filled with wrath, a real anger at what Jesus had said. What Jesus says to them sets off something completely catastrophic in their minds, doesn't it? It flips them. They go mad. They want to kill him. So what on earth is it that's so offensive? In Jesus' speech, he says, basically, you're expecting me to perform for you. Do what you did in Capernaum, in your hometown. They're expecting him to do in Nazareth what he's done elsewhere. They want him to prove himself to them. You remember last week? If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here. The words of Satan himself are still fresh in our ears from last week. Satan puts Jesus to the test. And here we see Jesus saying, that's what you're going to do to the people of Nazareth. They're demanding the same thing. Prove yourself to us, Jesus. Show us here in your hometown that you are who you say you are. They want Jesus to give in to their demands. And so do you see the offensiveness of what Jesus says to them next in verse 25 to 27? Let's read it again. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time, when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath, in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha, the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian. These two stories, the one of Elijah and the one of Elisha, come from 1 Kings and 2 Kings separately. And they're stories taken from the very worst time in Israel's history as a nation, basically. They're really, really bad at this time. Idolatry was prevalent, good leadership was completely non-existent, and God was just ignored. The people did what they want. So what does God do? He takes his blessing elsewhere. Elijah wasn't sent to any of the widows in Israel, but to someone outside of Israel, because Israel was ignoring him. Elisha didn't heal, by God's power, any of the lepers in Israel, but Naaman, one of the military leaders of Israel's neighbours. God takes his blessing to those outside of his people when his people reject him. The question has to be asked though, doesn't it? Is it really that serious, what the people of Nazareth are doing? It doesn't seem it, perhaps. Are the people of Nazareth really rejecting God in this situation? Well, I think the answer is loud and clear in their reaction to what Jesus says. They're livid. They know it's true. And they're furious that he's saying his blessing will be taken elsewhere. They take Jesus to the edge of a cliff to kill him, just for saying those words. They reject, in his hometown, the Son of God, and try to get rid of him. They want him to give in to their demands to perform miracles and wonderful signs for them, to prove himself. They want God, in the person of Jesus Christ, to give in to their demands. Do we see how twisted that is? They're setting themselves up over God, trying to make him do what they want. Don't underestimate the seriousness of this. They think God owes them because they have a certain background. They want Jesus to prove himself, just as Satan did in our passage last week. By doing this, they're setting themselves up as having power and authority to tell God what to do. And in doing so, they're rejecting the Creator God of the universe. Instead, they want some pathetic idol that they can twist, and it will do some kind of party trick for them. They reject Jesus' authority. But the thing is, for us, I think, reading this passage, it's very, very easy, isn't it, to read about the people of Nazareth and tut. Okay. Pathetic, isn't it? We wouldn't have rejected him. We wouldn't have crucified Jesus. We'd have known who he was. How stupid. Can't they see who Jesus is? I think when we start to say this, we begin to step dangerously close to the line. How easy is it for us to expect something from God when we act in a certain way? to expect him to bless us, perform some kind of miracle. So we give up our Saturday morning to clean the church. How easy is it for us to expect something back? Maybe it's just trivial. Everyone will be nice to us on Sunday morning. Maybe we give up a whole pile of money for the church. Isn't it right that God should bless us abundantly, or at least make life a little bit easier for us if we do that? Or maybe we give up a promising career and a nice lifestyle to buy a house in an area that's perhaps not so attractive. We commit to a church for the next 10 years of our lives, meaning we probably won't get promoted. We probably won't be able to do the things we want to do and have the holidays we want to have. Do we expect that God will make life a little bit easier for us because we've done those things for him? The people of Nazareth think God owes them because they're Jews, because they live in Nazareth. Jesus says they're wrong, and that in fact, by doing that, they're rejecting him. They're rejecting his authority. When we demand things of God, when we expect him to perform for us, we're rejecting his authority to tell us what to do, his authority over our lives. This is a prosperity gospel, and it's really, really dangerous. We must reject it, because if this attitude sinks into our lives, we'll become very disjointed, very disappointed with the Christian life. If we let it sink into our hearts, or if it already has, then we need to repent of that and submit to God's authority and not try and make him fit to our demands. So why does Luke put this passage at the beginning? I think it's to show the tension that Jesus' ministry will bring straight away. He doesn't want to hold back from that, does he? Jesus was not some kind of popular figure, popular political figure who tried to please everyone with the words that he said. He brought a message of truth, and where there is truth, there will be opposition. The shock here is that it's not the people that we'd expect, is it? The people we expect to follow Jesus, the Jews from his hometown, reject him. We'll see as we go through Luke's gospel, the people that we expect to reject him are the people that accept him. Jesus' ministry is groundbreaking. It's different. It goes against the mold. The truth of the gospel he proclaims goes against everything that people were living for. Goes against everything that people think is possible. And so Luke begins not with a great political statement about how great Jesus' ministry is going to be and how many miracles he's going to perform, but a statement of the message that he bears, that he brings to the world. A message that will cause rejection as well as acceptance. The gospel presents every single one of us in this room with a choice. And where there is choice, there can be rejection. Well, we move on. In the second half of our passage today, we're going to see the second mark of Jesus' ministry, and it's authority. Authority. So this is the whole of the second half of our passage. What we're going to see in this passage, in this section of the passage, is two things. We're going to see two instances of miracles, and then those miracles multiplied. So we see two individual miracles, and then those miracles multiplied. I think Luke is deliberately telling us about these events as a contrast to what happens in Nazareth. In Nazareth, the people were amazed. Do you see where it says people were amazed at his gracious words? His gracious words. Here in Capernaum, when Jesus gets up to preach, we're told that the people were amazed because Jesus' words, his message, had authority. And that sets the tone for what happens next. Jesus' very words carry the authority of God. We've touched on it, haven't we, in the World We All Want series that we're doing in Cafe Church. Jesus speaks and things happen. In Genesis 1 and 2, when God is creating a world, he speaks into nothing, into darkness. And things are created. It's by the power of his word. Here in our section today, Jesus speaks. And demons are expelled. Evil is taken out of people. Jesus speaks and sickness is cast out of people. People are made well again. There are powerful forces of evil on display in this passage. I don't want us to underestimate that in verses 31 to 37. And yet even over the forces of evil on display, Jesus has authority. If we downplay the power of these forces, or if we make them sound a bit petty, like it's tempting, isn't it, to say the demons aren't really that powerful, because it's a bit scary. But if we downplay that, we downplay the power of Jesus' authority. There is great distress and suffering and pain, isn't there, in this world? Don't have to look far to see that. And if we believe that Jesus only has limited authority, then we don't believe in a Jesus that can sort these problems out. But if we recognise the scale of authority that Jesus has in these verses, then we recognise that Jesus has the authority to cast out evil from this world, to reverse the processes of Genesis 3 that we were looking at last week. And one day he will bring about a world that we all want, a world that is right. Once again, in this passage, we see that repeated phrase in verse 37. People recognise Jesus' authority, and the news about him spread throughout the surrounding area. Luke is building this picture for us. News is spreading about Jesus. There is a momentum behind him about what's going on. Luke, of course, is writing to tell us that these things are true. He wants his readers to go away and say, well, if the news was spreading so much, people must know about this. This wasn't a select few people that knew. This is like the whole countryside. Luke's saying, go and find some sources. Go and ask some people. You'll know it's true because they'll tell you. They heard this news. They knew what was going on. Well, the second of two miracles that Luke tells us about in detail is the healing of Simon's mother-in-law. Now, I was convinced that at this point I would be able to get a mother-in-law joke in, but I couldn't, so it's a shame. Mainly because Amy's here, and my mother-in-law is lovely. So the story in this passage is incredibly short, isn't it? It's just a couple of verses. It's very simple, yet it complements what is before and what comes after perfectly. It's a wonderful glimpse of the authority which Jesus has, which will one day rule over our world. He simply leans over and rebukes a fever which was making her really ill. Literally, he leans over and tells off the fever, and it goes. Immediately, Simon's mother-in-law is up, back to work. She's feeding them, she's serving them in the house. It's a miniature reversal, isn't it, of that process in Genesis 3 that we looked at last week. He pulls back the consequences of the fall, sickness and illness and death. He reverses the consequences of the fall to take away her illness. And it's a glimpse of what is to come, when Jesus' authority will cast out all evil and sickness and pain and suffering from this world once and for all. It's a proof as well, isn't it, that Isaiah 61, that little passage that Jesus quotes in the synagogue, is true. Jesus here is bringing about the healing of the sick. He's bringing about the recovery of sight to the blind. That's the same thing, the reversal of Genesis 3 consequences. Jesus has authority to do those things. And as the day draws to a close, as the sun was setting, it says in verse 40,
We see the multiplication of these events. Let's read it, just to remind ourselves. When the sun was setting, the people brought to Jesus all who had various kinds of sickness, and laying his hands on each one of them, he healed them. Moreover, demons came out of many people, shouting, "You are the Son of God." But he rebuked them and would not allow them to speak because they knew he was the Christ.
The point, of this is that the miracles that Jesus has just performed, they're not one-offs. Jesus isn't a flash in the pan. He's not a one-trick pony. He's God. His authority is consistent and eternal.
Yet Jesus rebukes the evil spirits and tells them that they're not allowed to tell people who he is because they knew he was the Christ.
And I don't know about you, but this seems really odd to me. Why does Jesus tell them off? Why doesn't he want them to tell people who he is? Why doesn't he want people to know he's the Christ? Well, I think for Jesus, he wants people to work it out themselves. He wants people to see what he does and hear what he says, come to the conclusion that he's the Christ. He doesn't want words of life to come from places of evil. It's a contrast. As the disciples spend time with Jesus, and we see that in Luke's gospel, the relationship that Jesus has with his disciples, they begin to have the scales pulled from their eyes. They begin to see who Jesus is. And of course, in Luke's second book, Acts, we see them get it. They get it, and they go about telling people. Now, I think it's worth saying here that miracles in Luke's gospel are going to be really important. So if you are unsure about miracles, then it might be quite an uncomfortable time for you. The point of this, I think, is that miracles are miraculous. It seems obvious, doesn't it? But a lot of people write off miracles. They say, miracles can't happen. The point of miracles is that they're miraculous. They don't happen every day. We can't repeat them. We can't just say to someone, so we can't just rebuke a fever and it will come out of them, because they're miraculous. They're abnormal. Jesus is God himself, and he has the authority to change the way the world works, to change the order of things briefly or for a time. We see that, don't we, when he calms the storm in a few passages' time. I don't want to get too ahead of myself. He has control over the weather in the same way that he has control over fever and things like that, which we don't. We don't have that power. Think of Jesus' words that he quotes from Isaiah 61 again, just back in 18 and 19. He will bring freedom for prisoners that we've sung about this morning already, and recovery of sight for the blind. These things are gospel images. We are prisoners to sin and death, and yet he frees us from those things, brings freedom to prisoners. He'll give sight to those who are blind. We are blind until we know Jesus. We live in darkness until he brings light into our lives and allows us to see the truth. And these things are miracles in every single one of us who claims to be followers of Jesus Christ. Something miraculous has happened. Jesus' miracles in his time on earth show us his authority to free us from sin and death and bring us to new life. If we don't believe he can perform miracles like rebuke a fever, cast out a demon, how can we possibly believe that he has the power to bring us from death to life? Miracles are important. We need to know that as we carry on through Luke. In verse 43 then, as we come to the end of this passage, we get a wonderful summary of Jesus' ministry. Let me read that quickly to you. Speaking to the people who'd been harassing him, basically telling him to stay, he says this. He said, "I must preach the good news of the kingdom of God to the other towns also, because that is why I was sent." Jesus has come to preach the good news of the kingdom of God. The good news that he has authority to rescue a world from its sin. That he can bring about freedom of prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind. That's the good news that we're talking about. He hasn't come to perform miracles necessarily. The miracles bear witness to what he says. What he's come to do is proclaim that message. So what then can we take away from this passage? It's quite a big chunk, isn't it? There's a lot to take in. It's all well and good, isn't it, for us to know that Jesus has authority, to believe that's true, to sign up to that. But does that really make any difference to us as Christians living day to day? Recently, the author of a number of Christian books had the privilege of chatting to him, and he said to me that he thinks the question of which authority we choose to obey, which we touched on earlier on, is one of the defining questions in our lives. Do we choose to obey Jesus' authority or that of our idols? Do we choose to submit to him or try and make him submit to us? Clinging on to particular sins that we actually quite like, we don't really want to give up. Sins that perhaps we've done for so long that we've just come to be dulled by them. We don't really see the pain that they cause anymore. It's rejecting Jesus' authority to eradicate sin from us. Picking and choosing which bits of the Bible that we like, which bits we listen to and which bits we choose to ignore. It's ignoring God's authority to teach us from his word. Jesus has authority that we need to submit to. But I want to make really clear this morning that this isn't a message that will always see people accept it. We see that, don't we, in Nazareth? And that is an important lesson for us as we seek to tell sinners like us the wonderful message of grace. Some will reject that. We need to submit to Jesus' teaching because he's God. We need to submit to his authority because he is the one that brings us from darkness into light. How do we know? Well, because we see in the miracles an example of him doing that. But I don't want all of this just to seem like some kind of message of doom and gloom. That we just submit and get told what to do and there is no joy in that. Because I think that is not the case. I think it's quite the opposite. Because the message is that God loves us and cares for us so much that he uses the full weight of his authority over the world and everything in it to bring about rescue for his people. Because he loves us. He brings about the rescue of sinners by his authority. God loves us so much that using his authority he sent his son to the cross. And Jesus, being the perfect human, recognized God's authority to do that and submitted to it. Jesus himself has words that have perfect authority. And that is wonderful news for human beings. Because when Jesus dies on the cross and says, "It is finished," we believe he has the authority to make that declaration and that statement is true. Because of what we see of Jesus' authority in this passage, we can know that he has the authority to state, "It is finished." He has defeated death. That sinners can be reconciled to God. The message of Jesus' authority is wonderful news for every single person. At his death, Jesus faces his ultimate rejection, doesn't he? The people, everyone, rejects him pretty much. And this time they do kill him. Yet it is at this moment that he earns his ultimate victory.
if you don't know Jesus, if you haven't submitted to him, to his authority, the wonderful news is that you can. Anyone can. Because with those words on the cross, Jesus is opening a way for every single person, every sinner like me and you, to be assured of eternal freedom. He pays the price for my sin and the sin of all those who trust in him. And he says, it's finished, it's done. There's no more left to pay. Jesus' words are words of perfect authority. And I want to say they're words that you can trust. If you do know him, if you do submit to his authority, I guess the question is to ask, how do we live in the light of Jesus' authority? Do we go on expecting him to serve us? Or do we delight in the freedom he's bought us? In his words of authority? And do we choose to serve him? Do we carry on listening to alternative voices of authority and picking and choosing which bits we like of Jesus or the Bible? Or do we actually choose to submit to his perfect rules? That is perfect rule. Live lives of submission to God, to Jesus. His words of authority brings us life. Let me pray, and then we're going to sing together.